Okay, so today I will be presenting the results of a research that we carried out in a big group. This is it's actually an analysis comparing the patterns and the types of care provision of older people and of older people in good and in poor health in Europe. This is part of a bigger, wider research effort financed by the European Commission. It's called MoPACT. And this is actually a very large framework focusing on active aging, and the little piece that we've been working on were the determinants of care provision as a form of social participation. This is a quick overview of the presentation. So we're gonna start with a theoretical framework, that data and methods. I'll present some results, and then we're gonna conclude with directions for public policy. I was already telling you a bit about MoPACT. So in this context of promoting active aging and healthy living towards the end of life, we're trying to support older people in to continue their social participation, because that's been shown to be correlated with more active, healthier living. And in particular, we're looking at informal care provision as a form of social participation. Informal care provision having been identified already in different EU policy documents as one of the important dimensions of social participation. And our contribution mainly to the existing literature is that we try to differentiate between the patterns of older people in relatively better health and those who might be suffering from health problems and might be limited in their potential by the presence of chronic diseases. We use this theoretical framework to guide our work. So we consider the care provision decision to be determined by a number of individual factors that are listed here, among them opportunity structures, family structures, and socio-demographic characteristics. Of course, there are external determinants as opposed to the individual determinants. There are contextual and cultural factors that might weigh very heavily in the decision, but they're not the focus of today's work. And finally, we conceptualize the caregiver's health not as an individual determinant, but if you want, as a modulator and a dimension that impacts and might influence the effect of all the other factors. And this is mainly the main link of our work with the active aging framework, is that while people become while their health deteriorates, they might be impaired or limited in their social participation, and at that point, following Verbrugge and Liete, you have made the step from physical ailment to disability, when your health status impairs you from continuing a certain standard of participation and activity. To give you a better idea of what we mean by all these indicators, here is a list of the proxies we used, the actual variables we used in the model. And this is a very important thing to say. Our conceptualization of health, the main health dimension we use, is the presence or not of multimorbidity. That means individuals who suffer from two or more chronic conditions simultaneously, these people are considered to be in poor health. We obviously can accept from the start that this is not a perfect measure. You could see in our data that some people with two or more chronic conditions actually report themselves in good health. But it was important to make the distinction along these lines, because it's a clear-cut threshold, if you want, and also because it can always relate back to this idea of the burden of chronic conditions on the older population. Quickly, opportunity structures are pretty much the usual: education, income, employment status, social participation. We have more indicators for that. We use volunteering, participation in religious activities, participation in clubs, continuous education. Family structure refer mainly to household size, number of children, marital status, age, gender, socio-demographic, and we also include other health status controls, which I'm not going to present here because they're exclusively used as controls, self-reported health, poor mental health, disability, in recognition of the fact that health itself is a multidimensional concept that we obviously cannot capture just by dividing between multimorbid or non-multimorbid. Another contribution we make to the literature is that we clearly distinguish between three different types of informal care, and this is one of the strengths in our data, because this is a distinction that a lot of times cannot be made. And there are three types of care that we analyze separately. So the provision of co-residential care is refers to care to not necessarily an older adult, but a frail or disabled adult in the household. Extra-residential care has a flavor of regularity, again, of care provided to an adult, but outside the household. And finally, grandparenting, which is care for one's grandchildren, so there are familial ties, but the care is not necessarily provided in the household of the grandparent. Okay. So the data and methods, we are using data from the SHARE survey that you've heard quite a bit about, and we're using all three available panel waves. So that means data collection that ran between 2004 and up to 2012. We're capturing almost a decade. We're focusing on the 10 countries that are present in all panel waves, so as opposed to other presenters here, we have a reduced set of countries, but they still cover northern, central, southern Europe, so they should give us a fairly good image of the situation in Europe. All in all, we have almost 80,000 observations, but because of considerable attrition rates, that the panel is very imbalanced, so we really have almost 50,000 individuals. Finally, the models we estimate, I'm not going to go in much detail, are logistic regression models. We account for individual level heterogeneity, we use random effects, and we control for time and country fixed effects. Okay, the results, the first thing that is important to note is that the participation rates in different types of care vary markedly across Europe, and I don't think this would surprise anybody, but it's just interesting interesting to see how much they differ, especially for grandchild and extra-residential care, which are participation rates are much, much higher in Northern Europe with respect to Southern, within Central Europe. The opposite is true if you look at co-residential care. You tend to see higher rates in Spain or in Italy, so Southern Europe, with respect to the other two areas, and in the bottom, the European average. Yeah, I would guess everybody who's familiar with the situation would expect this. Also interesting to see that there are very different participation rates between different types of care. So obviously, many older Europeans provide some form of grandchild care, or extra-residential care, which is generally less intensive, and much less would provide co-residential care, so care within the household. This is an overview of our results. So in order to maintain comparability between groups, I'm presenting average marginal effects here, so these are not regression coefficients. What we did was estimate models for every type of care individual, independently, and then predict for different subpopulations. One population would be the no multimorbidity group, so our good health group, if you want, and the other population would be the multimorbidity group, so the poor health group. And what you see is the darkly shaded columns are the differences and their level of significance. And I'm going to walk you through this a bit because it's quite a few numbers. But I think what's very interesting is that we see a lot of significant differences. So you would see that a lot of the determinants have a significantly different impact in one group with respect to another. But you would also know that that is really confined to the size of the effect. there are really no determinants on this table that, that change size or significance of association between groups. So it's really not that the determinants are different at all, it's just that their impact, their importance in the decision to provide care might vary between good and poor health, here multimorbidity or no multimorbidity. And what is also interesting, if I go back to this, is that there are very, very marked differences between the three types of care, much more so than there are between different multimorbidity groups. So you would see that co-residential care really stands out. So this is tends to be very intensive, time-consuming, straining care provided for maybe longer hours, and it really doesn't share much of the characteristics of a voluntary activity. It looks a lot in our sample as if it's a bit of an obligation for or perceived as a burden by the family member. So you would see that it is less determined by family structures or by opportunity structures, and more so by family structures. So by the characteristics of the family group. On the other hand, extra-residential care, which is much more like grandparenting, they seem to be lighter in nature, if you want, a more voluntary type of activities, and they are better modulated through these opportunity structures. So, the other direction. So you would see that our proxies here have a higher impact, your income, your education. And I think this point of the difference between the three types of care is well captured by this graph. These are just some selected variables, but they would generally be the most interesting one. And you could see, the different colored bars vary by morbidity group. And you can see that there is pretty much always a small difference, but that's really nothing as compared to the difference between the three charts. Age, for example, so being in the last age category, and here the reference group is the lowest age, which is 50 to 64. So we're only looking at the elderly. You would see what a large impact it has on the probability to provide care. Of course, this is, part of this might be explained by the fact that grandchildren grow up and they don't need care anymore. But it's the same in the case of extra-residential care. Much less important in the case of co-residential care. This is true for education as well. This is true for labor market participation, so pretty much for most of our indicators of opportunity structures. So this I've already touched upon slightly. Family structures, of course, I don't think this surprises anybody, are very closely tied to the decision to provide co-residential care, and obviously with the decision to provide grandchild care, but less so with the provision of extra-residential care, which interestingly in our sample is you would see the majority of cases are still related to family members, but there's quite a few situations where older people provide care for friends, for neighbors, or for very distant relatives. So it's obviously the wider social network that is involved here. And again, not surprisingly, socio-demographic characteristics are very closely tied to the decision of providing any type of care. And you would see how the probability of providing care changes a lot depending on the age group you're in. So visually, again, just to give you a better idea of those results, and I would caution you that the vertical axes are different here, so that might be a bit misleading. So these graphs, the blue, red, and blue, red, and green lines here are the better health group, the no multimorbidity group. The lower lines, the yellow, light blue, and red, I think, those are the poorer health group, and we plotted them by education and, as you can see, by age. And if you look just at the extra-residential care graph, there is a clear difference between morbidity groups And this is significant, the significance, so these are confidence intervals. But there's an even more marked, if you want, difference between age groups. And it's clear that older people can have a limited probability or lower probability of providing care. They have a limited potential to do so. But interestingly, the slopes are not different. So the effect of education on the decision to provide care doesn't really vary much between age groups or between health groups. So the dynamics, if you want, the structure of the decision process is the same, despite the fact that the intensity of the effect might vary. The co-residential graph is a bit noisier, a bit more confusing. You would see we also have much wider confidence intervals because we have much fewer observations as well. But I will note that the age differences are maintained. I will note also that the association with education is really, well, first of all, it's negative, if at all, but it's really not marked at all as compared to the other one. And the differences between groups here actually seem to be wider. So if we compare the oldest groups, the 75 plus, that would be red and green. So they do cross a lot, but there are marked, really very marked differences between groups. So it seems that in the case of co-residential caregivers, the people in poor health might be even more exposed to being isolated, to being stuck in this situation. But and of course, very different type of processes, very different type of very different decisions, extra residential and co-residential care. On the other hand, extra residential care and grandchild care, as I was saying before, much more similar in these dimensions. So education as an opportunity structure and age, you would see how the two graphs are very similar. And again, unfortunately, the axes are different, so the effects are stronger here. But plotted like this, it emphasizes how similar the two processes are. And we observe different differences between health groups, more marked differences between age groups, and the positive association. So opportunity structures matter a lot in the decision to provide extra residential or grandchild care. So let me wrap up with a couple of tentative conclusions and maybe directions for public policy. What we see clearly in the shared data is that older people in poor health are limited in their capacity to remain socially active, at least for the provision of care, that the dimension that we looked at. You see that people who do not suffer from chronic conditions are more able to participate, are better providers. Social policy would be well informed to target people with suffering from multimorbidity and support them support them to maintain a high social engagement level. But that being said, as the structure of the decision itself is not different, one could argue that the same policies can be used for people with or without chronic conditions. So there doesn't seem to be any evidence that we need to tailor make specific policies for this group of people. They could very well be just more intensively targeted. Okay. Co-residential care, we found, is negatively associated with other forms of social participation. That means that co-residential carers are at high risk of becoming socially isolated. And that makes it important to support them. Keeping them socially involved might feed into keeping them healthier and stopping their health from declining faster. These are, again, I'll remind you, these are all older people. So these are people in their 60s or their 70s who might not be in very good health themselves, but have to care for a partner or a close relative that is very dependent. Tentatively, at the country level, we observe that in southern European countries, the rates of co-residential care provision are much higher. So generally, for these states, the direction for public policy should be to strengthen the formal care system in order to give to take some of the burden away from the informal carers. In northern and central European countries, where co-residential care levels are much lower and extra-residential and grandchild care levels are higher, and these activities in themselves, we do not find that they reduce the level of social engagement. If anything, they're conducive to more social engagement in older age. In these countries, then, policies are best targeted at low-income or low-education groups, so the groups that are less likely to participate and support this defavored groups, keeping them from social isolation. That's it for me, and thank you very much for your attention. If you have any questions? Yeah, please.
Actually, I have two questions. One is that I was amazed by the low rates of co-residential care.
Yeah.
Because co-residential care probably is the relative importance of co-residential care and extra-residential care is reversed in Japan. It's the other way around in Japan. And one of the reasons for that is that the people are very afraid that if the older frail couples left alone, or the person left alone, could die without being noticed.
Okay.
So that's the kind of a social, concern that almost forces the children or other relatives to take in
the relatives,
to provide the co-residential care. Doesn't that same sort of concern apply to the European countries?
I think this, in a sense, these results might be a bit deceptive, and you always have to keep in mind that they refer to a very specific population. So we're only looking at people 50 or above, but really the bulk of our sample is between 65 and 100.
Yeah.
So these are all old people themselves. Mm-hmm. So we're not really talking of daughters taking in their mothers to provide support. And mainly, a lot of this co-residential care refers to support to a partner. So it's an elderly couple, but as one partner might be in poor health, the other one would provide help. You'd also expect this to be severely underestimated, because I would imagine most people provide care on a regular basis, but are just so used to the idea of it that they just report it as, it's just our family dynamic. So it would have to be, I would think, fairly intensive care for it to get reported as such. So the fact that, I don't know, a spouse might help with his or her partner dressing or cleaning himself, or this might not get reported most of the times. And I think what we're capturing here is really very intense care. And the way the question is formulated as well, there's this flavor of very high regularity, and it specifically says that you're not supposed to report short-term episodes. So I don't know if your spouse fell and broke a leg and he's only dependent for 3, 4, 5 days, then that wouldn't get captured here.
For instance, in your co-residential care, the husband being looked after by wife, it's included?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
Because in Japan, the first thing that happens when old couple, so one of the partners of the old couple needs long-term care, is that usually it's the husband. So the wife looks after him. And after he is deceased, then the children, her children have to decide whether or when they should take her in. And even in that case, co-residential care is very, very popular. So if you look at the rates of residential and extra-residential care, the ratio is really reversed.
Yeah. It could be that there's a very big cultural difference that feeds into this, and that's certainly modulated by all these specificities in the population that we're referring to as well. So, yeah, please. Oh, did you have another question?
Can I?
Yeah, please. Okay. We have 5 more minutes.
So you have talked about the social participation, encouraging social participation of the low-income, low social economic class.
Generally all classes in older age.
Is there some sort of evidence that the social participation sort of promotes health or longevity or benefit?
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't reference it here, but yes, there is some research that's pointing out to faster declines in health once older people become socially isolated. So in reverse, if you want, keeping one active and socially engaged would at least delay the onset of disability or any other negative health outcomes. Yeah, it's not in our research, but yes, there's a proven correlation in that direction. Yes, you had a question.
I was just wondering, because when elderly provide care for their spouse, then that would be captured in here as a co-residential care, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, if they live in the same household, yes.
Yeah, but it is often the case that one of the two partners dies, and then it's the person is left on his own. So I wonder why these figures are so high. Because near the end of life, there's only one spouse left. So it can be below 50% percentage. That's it.
No, these are for grandchild and these are for extra residential care. So extra residential care is caring for somebody who doesn't live with you in really wide terms. So outside the household. And it can be that it's a partner in a sense. So you would see that there are married couples that live apart, or it can be for a brother or sister. It can be for children, unfortunately. So I think I know that the majority of cases in our data are actually referred to care provided to close family members. I think somewhere around 60%. The rest, however, is provided to neighbors, or I don't know, an aunt of an aunt, so, or they cite some familial degree of the I don't know, third, fourth level. So, this is definitely co-residential care is really tied to the couple in our sample, or to child or dependent close relative. Yes, please.
I am having much more with you. Most of the caregivers did not change in the provision type of care. As I mentioned, correlation care providers, their spouses, yes,
I'm not sure I understand. You mean if the same person provides more types of care, or if within a family?
Whether there's a change from the extra-residential to co-residential care?
Ah, yes, that's interesting. We didn't look at it specifically here, but because it's a weakness of the data. It doesn't really allow us to identify cases where, I would imagine, as the care recipient declines in health, there would be situations where they would move in to be cared for in a closer, easier way, in a sense. But we cannot capture that here. Yeah, it's really 2, even 4 years between waves. So we don't have a finely grained enough, time structure to look at these dynamic processes as they happen. So, okay, I think that's it for me.